All right. So tonight I'm going to talk about the Buddha teaches an attitude, not an affiliation. And as I said earlier on, you know, whatever comments I make is in the context of the teachings and the lecture. It's not meant to be good or anything. So I might even pick on the picture, which I know that you spend a lot of time, you know, drawing. Now I'd like to quote from Rahula, who he is the author of a very good book called What the Buddha Really Teaches. And it's a book that was written in 1978. And it's one of the books that if you want to read a book, a good book about what the Buddha really teaches without all this modern day technology about the neuroscience and all those things, that's a really good book. Right? And he was actually a Buddhist monk who lived a long time in France. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, this book was actually written in French and then translated. So some of the language are a bit stilted. But to me, I mean, it's one of those books. It is very thin. It's a softback book. Sorry, no e-book, nothing. I probably can get it from Amazon. But it's one of those books that you can carry in your handbag and read on the plane. And I read it about 10 times, I think. And I still find gems in the book every time. But there's this quote that I particularly want to share with you today. And it says, there are some who believe that Buddhism is so lofty and sublime a system that it cannot be practiced by ordinary men and women in this world of ours today. However noble and pure and Buddhism may be, he said, it would be useless to the masses of mankind if they could not follow it in their daily life. But Rahula said, if you understand the spirit of Buddhism correctly, and not just the letter of the Buddhism, you can surely follow and practice it while living the life of an ordinary human being. And this is coming from a monk, right, who's saying, don't think of it being out in the bush or out all the, you know. And he says it very well, that the teachings of the Buddha will be totally useless if you cannot use it in your daily life. So that's what I'm going to look today. It's about why is it so important for us to understand what the Buddha really teaches, right? As what we often do, the practice of Buddhism. Now, very often people ask me, am I a Buddhist? My reply is usually, no, I'm not a Buddhist, but I am informed by the Buddha's teachings. Now, this is not just a question of semantics, like, you know, break down the language and start playing, you know, jokes with the language. To me, there is a difference between being informed by the Buddha's teachings and the idea of being a Buddhist. Because I think that the most popular misconception is for people to think that in order to understand and practice the Buddha's teaching, one has to adopt the Buddhist religion. Now, one reason for this is that most people understand the form of Buddhism rather than the substance, right? You know what the form is, all the rituals, all the paraphernalia, all the dressing of Buddhism, rather than the substance of Buddhism, what the Buddha really teaches. I believe that the Buddha teaches an attitude rather than an affiliation. Now, I need to explain this. So what the Buddha is saying is you have to cultivate an attitude that is Buddhistic, and I'll elaborate on that later, rather than belong to the Buddhist religion. He's not saying don't, right? He's saying that it's not important whether you do or not in order to practice the Dharma, which is the Buddha's teachings. And in fact, I think nowadays people are beginning to understand that there's no such religion as Buddhism in the Buddha's time. And that in fact, the religion of Buddhism came 200 years after he died, right? When all his followers have a congregation, they call it the First Council, where they said that unless we put down his teachings into a text form, we might lose it. And also, it will become debated and interpreted and all that. So they all came together and they then put it into three texts, which are called the baskets of teachings, right? And there's three main baskets, which is first the philosophical one, which we get the Abhidharma, and all those things which comes with the philosophy of the Buddha, including the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and all that, dependent orientation, which is the deeper side of the Buddha's teaching. Then he had another basket. Now, I can't remember the Pali words for it, and I'm not going to say it because it'd probably be wrong, right? But he has another basket where he calls it, the Vinaya is for the rules for the monks, for the sanghas, right? And there's many, many of them. For example, one of the things is the monks are not allowed to touch the hands of a member of the opposite sex, right? And that's why I think that some Westerners do not understand that sometimes when they put their hands out to shake the hands of a monk or a nun of the opposite sex, they usually withdraw because the Vinaya rule says you cannot touch that, right? And I've often seen that happen, and the monks always gently just go there. Now, that's not because they're rude. The rules does not allow them to do that. Then there's another basket called the teachings for the everyday people. And that's where the Jakarta tales comes in. These are the ordinary discourse that the Buddha gives for people who he calls householders, right? Little stories that he can tell you so that you can remember. Now, you have to remember that in the Buddha's days, there was no such thing as books, you know, iPhone, iPad, or whatever. It's all through transmission, word of mouth. And that's why in the Buddha's teachings, you find that numbers become very important, like the Four Noble Truths. Right? People can remember four. But if you don't have the number, they will start disputing how many truths there are. Okay? The Eightfold Path. So this is a mnemonic way of the Buddha helping us to remember. But then people start to say, this is what he said, we cannot change that. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's very important when you understand the Buddha's teaching, right? That when he says 4, 8 and things like that, he does not mean it in concrete. Like, it's like in the Christian religion when you say 10 commandments. I'm sure there are more than 10 commandments, right? But in the same way, when Christianity was established, it's also a way for people to remember. And numbers is one way of transmission, okay? So those are the three baskets that the Buddha started. And the difficulty with that is, as all forms of religion comes in, you get different interpretation, right? Whether it's in the Muslim religion, the Christian religion, or Buddhism, you get these things where they said, is what the Buddha said really true? Is it a metaphor? Is it an illustration? Is it a story? Or is this what they say? Right? And so you get this debate of the various forms of religious arguments coming. Now, when I was doing my PhD, I remember going to talk to, and I interviewed quite a lot of people, and one of them was Stephen Batchelor. You know Stephen Batchelor? Well, he's one of the well-known Western writer and monk. He wrote a lot of books on Buddhism, like when Buddhism comes to the West and things like that. And I said to him that I wanted to look at what the Buddha teaches, apart from whether it's Zen Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism or Theravada Buddhism. Like, what is the essence? And I said that through my research and talking to various people, I find that really, what the Buddha teaches can be come down to four main concepts. A, the Four Noble Truths, which is about the human condition, right? Secondly, about the idea of dependent origination, that things are interrelated, that one thing leads to another, the idea of karma. And then the other main concept are the three characteristics of existence. You know that, right? About that, the three characteristics of existence is A, everything is impermanent, right? Secondly, that there is nothing that is solid, in that we have a solid identity or self. Everything is a process, okay? And then thirdly, now I'm going to be stuck because I cannot remember. Okay, there's dukkha, anicca, and What is the other one, Charles?
You haven't mentioned suffering.
Sorry?
You haven't mentioned suffering.
No, suffering comes under dukkha. No, there's unsatisfactoriness. Anyway, it will come back to me. That's why I don't like the recording because, But basically, what I'm trying to say is that if you strip the Buddhist religion of either its tradition where it comes from or all the forms and everything, you get the essence of the Buddha's teachings, right? Which is about the Four Noble Truths, understanding the characteristics of existence and the fact that everything is interconnected. So why is this important? Because it relates to the idea of the Buddha teaching an attitude. Now, before I go on to this attitude thing, I wanted to say this because Charles, as you know, my husband, and I are very, very concerned, and that's why we often accept invitation to give talks and all that. Because mindfulness, the word mindfulness and meditation and the Dharma is now so bandied around that it's been misunderstood, misrepresented, and used. I mean, now you've got mindful cushion, right? Mindful yoga, mindful this, mindful food, and everything, so that the idea of it has become more of a buzzword. Okay. In fact, I'm running a series of training programs for professional firms, right? And so I made a search on the Google internet for the word mindfulness. Now, there's no price for this, but if, see whether you can guess. For the word mindfulness, right, where I just click in the word mindfulness, and this includes blogs and websites and papers and written papers and everything, right? How many hits do you think they have just for the word mindfulness? If you get close to 50,000, I will give you $10.
More.
Anybody can guess?
Maybe.
Yes. Look, you get free money, $10. And the margin of error is 50,000. Now, last week, 11,300,000 hits on Google only. I didn't even go to Bing and all those. Okay? That's one thing. On mindfulness and psychology, 27,800,000 hits. Right? Mindfulness and doctors, 50,000 hits. And the last one is a surprise to me. Mindfulness and accountants, 36,400,000 hits.
Wow.
This is blogs and comments and everything. And this is only Google, right? Anybody got nearest to 50,000? I got $10 here. Right. Now, does that mean that there are so many millions of people who are mindful? I think that you'll probably be the best judge of that. Right? So that's why I think it is very important for us to understand what is it that the Buddha is trying to teach and what is this attitude that he's asking us to cultivate. Okay? Because otherwise you'll end up to become one of those 40 million Google mindful people. Okay? Now, what do you think that the Buddha is trying to teach? And there's no price for this, okay? What attitude do you think he's trying to teach? A child's not allowed to answer. Just guess. No prompting either. Anybody? Come on, you heard me speak for so long. Some of this must have gone home. You know, you must have remembered something from my last few talks. Emily? Yeah? It's okay, I won't embarrass you. Okay. Anyway, I'm sure you know. But basically, you can actually summarize the attitude that the Buddha is trying to promote is one of acceptance and letting go. Right? We know that. But do you know that it is grounded, that this kind of attitude is grounded on seeing, knowing, which we are, you know, and everybody knows, but But the most important thing is understanding. Hence, when I write down the Eightfold Path, you see that the Buddha talks under wisdom, right understanding, and the word right qualifies all the Eightfold Path. Right understanding, right thoughts. Now, most of the people who have an understanding of the Buddha's teachings come from either thoughts, right, or seeing or knowing, but understanding, that's the attitude part, right? Because unless you really understand the essence of what he's teaching, your understanding of the Buddha's teachings will become very intellectual, right? You can probably quote the Nikaya, the Abhidhamma and all that, but when it comes to practice, it becomes very different, right? And I remember a story I might have told you before, but I'm telling you again because I think it illustrates the point that I'm making. Like, there was one person who came and said that she has a problem with her a teenage daughter, and the daughter finds it hard to go to school, do her homework, you know, the usual thing, too much television and all that kind of thing. And the mother screams and shouts at her. And she wants to try and be a better mother. And so she wants to learn compassion meditation, loving kindness, fine. So I was teaching her, and then she wasn't a client or anything, she was just a colleague of mine. And so every week she'll come back, and I said, how's the meditation? She said, very good, it's soaked. Very calming. And I said, what do you do? He said, oh, I wish my mother and I wish my colleagues and I wish everybody loving kindness and then lots of metta and everything. I said, very good. How's your relationship with your daughter? Ah, that's terrible. As soon as I opened my eyes, she hasn't done her homework. She's watching television. I scream at her and I shout at her. And I said, her to repeat, how's her loving kindness? Oh, very good. You know, I send it to my mother in Malaysia and this and that and everything. And then finally, she repeated it so many times. I asked her to repeat it so many times. She asked me, Belinda, why are you asking me the same question? Right? And I said, you've actually intellectually learned the Buddha's teaching. Right? It's very easy to send loving kindness to people that you don't know or not involved with or not annoyed with. Right? It's very hard to be loving to somebody where you have an emotional investment or attachment to. Right? So she can practice loving kindness to everybody except her daughter. Right? And then she started to understand, right, that it's her attitude that she needs to change. Right? Doing 10 loving kindness would be like going to church and doing 10 Hail Marys. And then you go out and you commit the same sin. Right? Yeah. So I think it's very important for us to understand that sitting in meditation, right, is good. It provides the foundation. But having a meditative attitude is what we need to practice. Okay? And if you've got any question you're dying to ask, and it will help everybody, please put up your hands if it helps your understanding. But if you have a question that's more personal or you want to crack a joke, that's also fine. But maybe you'll keep that for later. Okay. Now, this kind of attitude, the Buddha says, is developed through personal efforts and taking personal responsibility rather than relying on external source or orientation. Right? And that's why it's nice to have the picture of the Buddha here, and I'm all for it. But if you see this one as something you pray to or put on a pedestal, right, then it becomes an affiliation, not an attitude. Now, it doesn't mean that you cannot actually have an image of the Buddha to look up to, right? I have an image of the Buddha at home too. But what the Buddha does inculcate in us, and if anybody has been to Nantian and saw the three big statues of the Buddha, do you know what they're for? You know the big one where you go to the meditation hall?
I haven't been.
Okay, anybody has been? Nantian Temple in Wollongong? You ever see the big three statues of the Buddha?
They're right. Representative, I think.
Sorry?
I thought they were representative of the directions of, isn't it? each one?
There's probably a lot. But in the main hall itself, there's one that stands up, right? And one of them has a very angry look. Anyway, there's a lot of statues I know in Wollongong, right? And some of them are for people to actually pray to because the Mahayana tradition has more of a practice of worship, right? But there are three statues, and it's good to understand that, it's actually the qualities of the Buddha that people, when they are practicing meditation, are trying to inculcate in them, okay? And some of them are also anecdotes that you can apply. Like, so for example, if you are a very angry person, some of the meditation teachers would ask you when you're meditating to try and visualize the Buddha of compassion, right? Because that provides an antidote for a person who's very angry. Does that understand? So what they're trying to encourage is for you to emulate the qualities of the Buddha, not just worship the Buddha, okay? And so some people who find that they are, for example, have a very negative thoughts, right? Negative way of looking at things, right? They might ask to actually visualize the Buddha as the monkey god. Because then they show that your mind is like a monkey, right? So all these things are symbols, right, of practice. But what do? We start to worship it, right? And then we forget, why do I have this Buddha statue of compassion in my house? I mean, my mother does that, right? She has Kuan Yin, she has this, she has that. And every morning she forgets why she's praying, but she has to pray. And when I said to her, it's about compassion, then she started to understand that you're not praying to the Buddha of compassion or the Goddess of Mercy. You're trying to emulate the attitude of compassion. Does that make sense? Yeah. So while it's good for us to have images, because it keeps our mind focused, it is the quality behind the statue that we are looking at that we have to cultivate. Now, anybody's lost so far? Okay. Now, let me tell you a story about this thing about affiliation versus attitude. And there's this very old story that's been told of this man who, in India, who had been hearing that there was a very famous teacher, very good, and he wants to go and look for him, and he wants to become his follower. And then on the way, he met this man who is very, he's robed, but he's tattered and everything. And then he started to talk to him. And this person who was robed and very shabby started to give a discourse on life and things like that. And this young man was so convinced. He said, I want to be your follower. Right? And he said, but you don't know who I am. He said, doesn't matter. Right? Then later on, he found out that the person who was preaching is the Buddha. Right. Now, that story illustrates that when something is true, right, and something is relevant, right, it doesn't matter who is the teacher. Okay? Because what the Buddha is teaching is not based on beliefs. It is based on right understanding. And I'm sure many of you will know about his discourse to the Kalama clan when he first became enlightened, and he talked to the Kalama clan and said, do not take what I say or believe, what the book says, what the teacher says. Try it for yourself. Right? And if it's true, adopt it. If it is not relevant to you or not skillful, then drop it. So the emphasis the Buddha has always put has always been experience. Right? And the fact that you have to take personal responsibility to try it out. And that's why I get very concerned when people ask me, can I learn meditation from a CD or from a book or things, or when people engage me to teach them, to train them, right? And they want only an hour of training. Is that enough? Right? And they're happy to pay a lot of money. And I said to them that it would be actually cheaper and easier if they were to buy a book. Because after 1 hour of talk or training, they will get nothing. They will get a start of it, right? And if they're not prepared to follow it up, then they might as well read the book. It's the same thing, right? So the idea that the Buddha teaches is not only to read about him, hear about him, you have to practice it in your own life, right? And one of the attitudes he talks about is adopting the beginner's mind. What's a beginner's mind? How many people truly have beginner's mind, like a child's mind? No dishonest people here, but now, what is the child's mind? Right? A child's mind is very clear, no rumination, but you know, contrary to what we believe, a child has very good understanding. Right. And they're able to share this because they're not full of what will people think of me? Will they like me or they won't like me and things like that. They're not into, you know, like the election you can see, they're not into selling. Right? They don't care about polls or you know, or Gallup poll and things like that. And I had a very good experience with my grandson yesterday, because he's 3 years old and he just came back from America with my daughter and the family, so he's very jet-lagged, but he came and stayed with us in the afternoon. And about 2 o'clock, he woke up. I guess he's a bit, you know, still disorientated. And he asked for his mother. So that's fine. I said to him, I'm supposed to have him for the rest of the day, but he wants to see his mother. So I said, that's fine. We'll call mother and all that. So we called the mother. He talked to the mother, and we're going to take him home 3 hours before he's due to go home. Right? That's fine. And then once I settled down, then he said to me, 10 minutes later, he said, Nai-Nai, that's grandma, he said, Nai-Nai, I don't want to go home anymore. I said, well, that's all right. Why is that? He says, because when you first wake up, you miss your mother. Now I don't miss my mother so much. Right? And I thought, you know, grandma is 3 years old, for him to be so self-aware, right, and be able to explain it. And that was amazing in itself. But what was even more amazing was 5 minutes later, he said to me, do you miss Chow Chow, which is great-grandmother to him, which is my mother, right? And I said, yes, but why do you ask that? He says, because she is your mommy. So I said, yes, I miss her. That's how, like, I miss my mommy. Now, this is a three-year-old. Now, when we think about it, it's amazing, right? But when we think of it from a child's mind, what the Buddha teaches, it's not amazing, isn't it? Because he's got no rumination, right? He's able to actually be self-aware. He's able to tell me how he feels, right? And more importantly, he's able to give me an illustration of how he feels from a position of empathy, right? He says, do you miss your mother, right? Now, I was really gobsmacked. But my best teacher are my 2 grandchildren because they're really there, you know. And also it teaches you that things are impermanent, the other teachings of the Buddha, right? One minute he misses his mother, he wants to go home now. And then he tells you, I don't miss my mother anymore, I just had a drink, right? And so on and so forth. Now, as a grandmother, as a mother, if you're not prepared to go with the flow, and I tell you, being a Buddhist in that sense has helped me a lot, you know, that I don't say, you say you're going, now we have to go, right? So by having an attitude of saying things are impermanent and that he has a beginner's mind, every moment to him is fresh, right? Because he's got drinks, he's now got a toy, so he wants to stay, and that's fine. Now, how many of us has the attitude that every time we have an experience, or we have a bad experience, we can look from it from a child's mind? You're smiling. Right? I mean, I myself included, right? Because what we do with our mind is this internal dialogue, right? Oh, I like that. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, I agree with that. Oh, and so on and so forth, right? Before we finish the talk, and I'm not sure how many people have lost now. Are you all listening to me? Right? Right? How many of you said, I like that? I'm going to tell my mother that. I'm going to tell my wife that. How many? Well, I only have two honest people. You mean the rest of you actually listen to me without any thought? I don't believe. But this is very common. That's what the mind does, right? And in fact, the other day I was giving a talk, running a workshop for medical doctors. And it's very interesting, medical doctors. Because I did that to them and I said to them that I know what their thoughts are. Like, I like that and don't like that and, you know, and why am I doing in this workshop, blah, 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 and all that kind of thing. And one doctor put up their hand and said, are you also a mind reader? How do you know my mind? I said, well, I got news for you, because your mind is like every other mind in this room. It's ruminating, it's always focused on what's good for me and what's not good for me. I said, how many words did you hear what I say? He said, not very much. But at least there's one honest doctor there. But isn't that the kind of attitude that we right? Like the Buddha says, that's why he talks about when you are mindful, non-judgmentally, right, openly, that doesn't mean that you cannot judge. But when you're judging, you're aware that you are judging. When you're thinking, you're aware you're thinking. And that's why when I teach meditation to people, right, they teach, okay, when you see yourself thinking, rather than start to engage in the movie of me, right, starring me, you know, produced by me, directed by me, right, you start to think, thinking, judging. You see it as a process. Like John Kabat-Zinn often say, make it into a verb, right? That way, you see that the feelings will come and go, right? But if you see that as solid, then you get very anxious about it. Does that make sense? Okay, now, I've completely lost my thoughts, of course, because I'm not supposed to be going this way. But never mind, I'm Buddhist, so I can go anyway. Okay, now, Rahula, the monk that I talked to you about, talks about this attitude in terms that the human qualities that and emotions that the Buddha encourages, such as love, charity, compassion, tolerance and patience, they are not sectarian, because these virtues and emotions, they are not Christians, nor Buddhists, nor Hindu, nor Muslim, or they don't belong to any religion, right? They come from developing the right attitude rather than the right affiliation. Does that make sense? Right? And in fact, this another monk called Abhijana, he cites Mother Teresa. You remember Mother Teresa? Right. He cites Mother Teresa as an example. He says that Mother Teresa is an example of a Catholic with a small c. Right? That means she's got a Catholic attitude. Not a Catholic with a big C. That means she's a Catholic. That means all the religious beliefs and things like that. And she said, for somebody like Mother Teresa, and you could equally put that for Nelson Mandela, it doesn't matter whether you call her the devil or a monk or nun or whatever. She'll still do whatever she does, right? Because she has that kind of attitude, not the affiliation, okay? And so from a Buddhist practice, it's the same thing. If you are a Buddhist with a small b, that means you have a Buddhist attitude, right? The right attitude, like open-mindedness, non-judgmental, and things like that, right? You will actually be cultivating the attitude that the Buddha teaches. But if you think of yourself as a Buddhist with a big B, I have to do this, I have to, you know, kowtow 3 times a day and things like that, then we're talking about the Buddhist religion. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, I like this quotation from another monk who wrote a book. I can't remember his book, but he says that one of his students paraphrased this kind of attitude very well. He says that when I study Buddhism, I'm studying myself, not a religion. Okay? When I study Buddhism, I'm studying myself, not a religion. Because the whole idea that the Buddha teaches is having self-awareness, self-understanding. And so we come to the Eightfold Path, right? The importance of what the Buddha teaches and the attitude that he promotes is actually captured in the Eightfold Path, which, as you know, is the Fourth Noble Truth. Right? Anybody do not know the Eightfold Path? Okay? So that you can classify it under three categories. Morality, which is under action, right speech, right livelihood. Mental culture, which is right effort, right concentration, right mindfulness. The wisdom, which is right understanding, right thoughts. Now, Batchelor says that the Eightfold Path does not suggest a belief system. It's actually a Dharma practice in action. Right? So it is not like the Ten Commandments. It doesn't say, thou shall not do this. Right? And I'm sure in its original state, the Ten Commandments probably are not that directive. But through the years, it probably become very directive. So the Buddha talks about right action. He does not spell out what is right action that you should be following. Okay? So in the Buddhist practice, it's not directive as to what is right or wrong. He doesn't talk about evil or good. He doesn't talk about guilt or sin. Right? The word right means what frees your mind from remorse. So in other words, it is in harmony within yourself and with another. And so the word that is used for the word right is sama, meaning skillful. So the question you ask yourself whenever you do something, speech and action and all that, is this skillful? Is this appropriate? If it is not, then you learn from it, you move on. Now, what that implication has for that kind of attitude is when you ask whether it's skillful or inappropriate, is there's no guilt, right? Because you know that if it is not skillful, you can always change and move on and do better. But if you tell yourself, is this right, should I have done this, there is a lot of guilt. And in Buddhist practice, and especially in the Tibetan language, there's no such word as guilt, right? But there is a word remorse. Because remorse, you're focusing on the action, right? If this is not skillful, you change action. With guilt, what you're focusing on is your feeling. And guilt is a feeling that's like a wound. It cuts and cuts and cuts. And all you do is land up feeling bad because you're focusing on the feeling bad, not on whether the action was appropriate or not. Do you see the difference? Right? So again, if you come down and understand the Buddha's teachings on attitude, it is about self-awareness. Right? Because to ask yourself, is this skillful, you actually have to be aware of having your mind quite calm, quite subtle, quite grounded, so that you can see what is my motivation for doing what I did. And if your motivation is correct, but the consequences are negative, you've changed. Right? Or even if your motivations are negative and the consequences are negative, you change. You have a choice. Now, so what is right action? What is right action? I love asking this question when I go to America, when I'm talking in America about right action, because often, especially in the Western world, they see right action as when there's injustice, or when there's suffering, or when there's something, we've got to do something about something, right? Even though we don't know anything, we still got to do something, right? But right action, and the word right is, you have to look again, right? What does the situation call for? Because sometimes right action involves doing nothing, right? Or right action involves having restraint. And you know, restraint is much harder than action, right? Especially how many people have partners, men and women, where you go back and tell your husband or your wife, I mean your boyfriend or something. And you said, you know what, I had such a bad day at the office and my colleague didn't like this and da-da-da-da-da, right? What would the man say? Oh, quit your job. Oh, go tell your boss. Oh, take the day off, right? They will always tell you something, right? Because men are very goal-orientated. They are very action-orientated, right? Whereas if you go and tell your girlfriend, they'll say, oh, it sounds like you have a bad day. Oh, you poor thing, you know? And then they'll talk about, would you like to go and have a hair wash with me? or something, right? So men are very action-orientated. So I particularly find that, especially when I talk to Western men, right, for them not to do anything is very difficult, right? And one of the things I find when I'm counseling couples, right, is the woman will say, I don't need you to do anything or give me any solution. I just want to hear myself talk. Right? See how the women are laughing. Right? And the man will say, but why do you ask me? We don't want any solution. Right? And then in 2 minutes, they'll be asleep. Right? Because they've given out something already. So that leads me to the next thing on the Eightfold Path. Right speech. Right? Sometimes right speech is noble silence, and that's why the Buddha says noble silence. If you don't know what to say, shut up. Right? And what is the hardest thing to do in retreat? Is to practice noble silence. Right? Now, have I told you this story about how, I think it was at Unibat years ago, about how this person was counseling the friend who just had a heart broken? I told you the story? Well, anyway, I'll tell again because, you know, it is so many years ago. I'm sure she's happily married. And but the question was posed to me about, you know, the four noble truths, like life is suffering and things like that, right? And the question was posed, so when do we tell a person that life is suffering, is unsatisfactory? Like, why? When do I tell my friends about the four noble truths? And I said to her, give me an example. Why do you want to tell somebody about the Four Noble Truths? She said, well, you see, my friend had just had her heart broken. You know, the boyfriend just left her. And she was very sad. And I told her, life is full of suffering. And my friend told me to shut up. And she said, why is that? Isn't that what the Buddha teaches? And I said, the Buddha talks about right speech, right? And right understanding. Now, your friend just had her heart broken, right, by her boyfriend, and you told her life is full of suffering, right? Now, how is that right speech, right? She said, but I didn't know what to say. Then I said, why don't you just keep quiet? Or say, I don't know what to say. Can I take you for a hair wash or something? You know what I mean? And I think this is very important. I mean, I try to make it light. But it's important about attitude, right? And if you understand what the Buddha is teaching, it's about looking at what the situation calls for. And this is the idea of what I term as respondability. And this was, can you see? No? Okay, so it's all right, thank you. Yeah. And this was actually my PhD thesis. Respondability, which refers to our own internal ability to respond. Okay? Because we all take responsibility, we want to be responsible for our family, our work, our company, and everything. We know it's about accountability, the roles and everything, the positions. But when something goes wrong and we are very stressed, it relates to our ability to respond. Right? It's in the same way, as I said, to like my grandchildren. They're my biggest teachers. Because every minute you have to learn to respond differently. Okay? When you have no sleep, like my daughter, she has no sleep, and the baby is still crying. It doesn't care that mom has no sleep. I'm hungry. Right? And so, respondability has to do with the attitude that the Buddha is teaching. Now, let me illustrate this in a few ways, because I think that the crux of what the Buddha is teaching about responsibility is for us to actually get in touch with our own internal resources to be able to respond to external circumstances or stress and all that. Because if you find that you don't have these internal resources, it takes very little from the outside to trigger off a lot of internal reaction. Okay? Now, who has heard of this analogy about the Zen mountains and rivers? No? Okay. So, you know, the Zen teaching is usually in the forms of story, right? And this is about the Zen mountains and rivers. I don't know what it's called originally, but I'll use it so often I call it Zen mountains and rivers. Now, what it says is, as the first level of understanding, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, right? They're just a different entity. At the second level of understanding, mountains are no longer mountains and rivers are no longer rivers. At the third level of understanding, mountains are mountains again and rivers are rivers again. So you're going back to the first level of understanding. But even though you're actually going back to the first level of understanding, the inside is 360 degrees, right? In terms of the teachings of the Buddha, in terms of the action that you take, in terms of self-development. So at the first level, when mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, we have this very black and white view of the world, right? It's them and us, the poor, the have-not. You see that in the election, class war, right? About the employers versus the employees, the university versus this, the men versus the women, misogynists, and it's always about them, us, them, us. And you can see that in the workplace where we talk about companies, the bosses, and us, right? So in terms of self-development, what we often think of is me against the world, right? And I often give the example, when we give to charity, right, we feel very good. We give to charity, then we say, excuse me, can I get a receipt, please? Is this tax deductible? Right? Basically, this kind of thing, because you see the mountains and rivers as different, right? You see the world and yourself as different. You always ask yourself, what is in it for me? And that's fine, because the charity still gets something, right? But it's important to you whether you get a tax deductible receipt, okay? So at the second level of the Zen mountain, they say that mountains are no longer mountains and rivers are no longer rivers, right? They become part of nature, okay? Now, while that is good and it's better than the first level, according to the Zen teaching, there is still quite a lot of self. And this is the idea that everybody's, I got to love everybody and everything becomes a moral crusade and all that because I mustn't think so much about myself, right? I should help other people. And what the Buddha teaches is that at this level, there is still the need to suppress the self. When you don't think about yourself, right, and you actually think that I mustn't think about myself, guess what? You are thinking a lot about yourself, except that you're actually suppressing the desire to think about yourself, right? So in terms of charity, we say, okay, no, I give the money and everything. I don't need a receipt. But you know what? People will think I'm such a good person. Right? There is a self. It's so subtle. And that's why I like Zen teaching, because it's really so subtle. Right? And then at the third level, they said, mountains are mountains again, and rivers are rivers again. So they're back to that. But what you see is that there is an interconnectedness. Because you know that it doesn't make sense to have rivers without the mountains, right? Because if you don't have the gradient, how are you going to have the rivers flow? If you don't have the rivers, who is going to cut the mountains into gorge? So there is this interconnectedness where one is not meaningful without the other. So we are part of nature, but we're still individually part of nature. So from this perspective, in terms of self-development, you see me and you see yourself as individual person, But we're connected by our interconnectedness. And this is the idea of dependent origination, of cause and effect. It's very hard for me to say, if I do this, somebody else won't get hurt. Okay? And this is, at this stage, is where the Buddha tried to teach people to cultivate the attitude of asking, what is the unique response in this unique situation? And this goes to the idea of respondability. So you don't ask, what about me and things like that. You're asking, what does this situation calls for? Right? And every situation, even when it's the next minute, will be different. Because at 7 o'clock, you will not have information that you will have at 7:01. Right? So 7 o'clock, you think, you know, okay, I'm going to leave. Like today, I thought, you know, whenever I go to New South Wales University, I'm late. Right? Because the traffic on Friday is really bad. Right? So we left at what time? 5 o'clock, 4:45. Right? And that's all right. My husband always sleeps during my talk. That's the only time he feels very peaceful. Because he feels that safety in numbers, you know. Yeah. So we left very early, right? But then we got here early because there was no traffic. So we got an hour to not to worry about. So we had a nice dinner. You know what I mean? So even though you can plan for 7 o'clock being like that, when you actually get on the road, something happens, right? So the third level of the Zen mountain is like that. And that's where meditation and mindfulness comes in very importantly. Because unless you can clear your mind, you will always be filtered and always be impinged or impacted by the previous information you have, even though now you have other information, right? So what the Buddha, when he talks about being present moment by moment, he means it. But how many of us actually live that way? I don't mean don't have any past, don't have any future. But I mean about, actually, you can have a plan. And this is the question that's always asked. Does that mean if I'm a Buddhist, I cannot make plans and have goals? By all means, have plans and have goals. Like me trying to come here and reach 7 o'clock, right? But when you hit a cul-de-sac or you hit a detour, like in your life, right? You've got to have the ability to say, okay, it's not going the way I hope it will go. Let me change, right? And that takes clear-mindedness and self-awareness, right? And to do that, you need meditation because you got to clear your mind. Otherwise, all the rumination comes in. Otherwise, you'll be directing another movie, the movie of me being early. What do I do with the rest of 1 hour? You know what I mean, right? So every moment, you're going to be faced with this kind of decision. Now, how many people have children? even if you don't have children, right? If you ever play with children or teach children or work with children, you know, right? That you have to operate at the third level of the Zen mountain. Right? Because they either poop, they eat, they sleep, or something. Okay? So you always have to be responding moment by moment. Now, any questions so far? Okay, then the other thing about having this attitude that the Buddha talks about, and it's very important in our modern day life, is having this right attitude to see what is important moment by moment helps you to make a distinction and also to be able to respond appropriately between major and micro decisions. Okay? Now, what are major decisions? Anybody doctors here? Medical people? Accountants? Okay, what subjects are you studying?
Engineering.
Okay, better still.
Now,
say if you're an engineer, right, you have to make a big decision. Right? You've got to say, okay, will this bridge be able to stand up if we load so many cars on it, okay? You have to calculate, blah. Those are major decisions. Then the micro decisions are the decisions you have to make moment by moment, right? The union workers said, I don't want to work today. I'm going to protest because it's 30 degrees. What do I do? Right? Or I don't have soap or things, anything. So every so the major decision, it's easier to see in terms of doctors. Major decisions for doctors are like euthanasia, organ transplant, cloning, IVF, things like that, right? But moment to moment, the doctors will still have to make micro decisions, right? And all of us have to do that. If you're a human being, you have to make micro decisions, which is moment to moment. And let me just read for you some of the micro decisions that you might have to make moment by moment. Now, that is the most unmindful thing I've done. Because I have now stapled two ends on my paper. Even though I wanted to come here, the micro decision is when I was putting the stapler, I wasn't mindful. So now I have paper that doesn't open. That is a micro decision. So what I'm going to do now is I have to decide, do I spoil it and tear it? Right. Okay, so let me read to you some of the micro decisions that you have to make. Okay, and it doesn't matter whether you're an engineer or doctor or accountant or psychologist, it applies to you. Which client or person to return the phone call or answer the email at the end of a tiring day, right? Isn't it a micro decision? You go home, you turn on your email, you see bling, 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 or as a digression, to my horrors, I heard on the TV they're promoting now from Galaxy or Samsung. They now have a watch. Yeah. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Called, what's that? Sample? Something, right?
Something watch.
Yeah, this watch. This is a digital watch, right? That will tell you when an email comes to your home. Ping. And then it will tell you when a phone call comes. Ping. Now, why do you want to be connected day and night? Right? And it's bad enough you go home and you go to read the email. Now you can't even get away for a walk because your watch will ping you. I mean, talk about mindfulness and meditation. You know, I think if they ping you to drop, might be better than telling you to the email. Anyway, so these are some of the examples of micro ethical decisions, right? Which person to return the phone call or answer the email at the end of a tiring day? What happens if your personal need for time conflicts frequently with the demands of your work? Right? So again, a decision that you have to make every moment. How might you respond to a friend, a colleague, or a client that you feel uncomfortable with? Right? Where all instinctively, all you want to do is get away. Okay, and the doctors have this problem. When I was teaching the doctors, they said that they have got a problem because some patients, they know that they can't do very much, you know, people with addiction and things like that. But they still have to help them, right? Now, when do you stop asking for more information and data and rely on your own judgment about something, right? I remember when I was lecturing in Macquarie, one of my students didn't hand in the assignment. And I said, why is that? Oh, I'm still looking for that book. I said, what book? Because you've given them the reference list and all that. I'm looking for the book that explains everything about this assignment. I said, there's no such thing. Right? And he said, so how am I going to do this assignment? I said, read the reference list, make your own judgment, and that's what we want from you. So we go through life like that. We're looking for that one thing that's going to make our life perfect, right? Or we're going to make that one decision that's going to be good forever. Now, Matthew Ricard, how many people have heard of Matthew Ricard? The happiest man in the world. He wrote the book called Happiness. And he says, everybody has their own order of how it would make their life happy, right? So he says, can you imagine if we were to do that online? And have this brochure that everybody can order and said, I want this to make my life happy. right, we would have to have a catalog for 13 billion people. Because everybody will have a version of what makes their life happy. Right? So if we keep looking for what makes us happy forever, what you end up is being very, very ego forever. Because every moment you will find that you need to change. Okay? Now there are other things like, what happens if your judgment about your work conflicts with the judgment of your colleagues or friends, especially the senior ones? Then the next one is even more important. How present are you with the client, the colleague, the family, or anybody that you're dealing with? Or are you already thinking of the next task, the next appointment, the next television program, or so on and so forth? Right? And what if you're feeling emotionally exhausted or burnt out? How much of your own personal limitations are you willing or able to share in your work settings? Right? Now, I'm not giving you any answers to this. I'm saying that every day, every moment, we all face these micro decisions. Right? And so while we often talk about meaning in life, purpose in life, and things like that, and these are what we call major decisions, the Buddha's teachings teach us to respond appropriately, moment by moment, because he's saying that what actually affects our well-being are micro decisions. Right? Like now, if I got to make a decision, do I take this route home, will there be less traffic, this, that traffic? You know what I mean? Isn't that? Now, all this cumulatively will make up your day, right? And there's no way you can make it perfect. So that's where meditation and mindfulness comes in, right? Because if you are prepared that when something goes awry, you can say, okay, this is not what I anticipated, I will do it differently, or I will respond differently. So the essence of what the Buddha is teaching in his attitude, everything that he teaches, the Four Noble Truths and everything, goes towards cultivating an attitude where you can respond skillfully and mindfully and calmly, right, to something that happens. Or if you decide that you're not going to be calm about it, you also know that you're not being calm. So it's about being aware of your state of mind constantly. Like one of my friend I was working with said, Melinda, this mindfulness stuff is no fun anymore. I said, fine. You know, I didn't think it was fun anyway. But you know, I said, what do you mean? He said, previously, I used to be so mindless. You know, I just do everything. Nowadays, since I practice mindfulness, I'm now mindful that I'm mindless. And so I can't get away with being mindless anymore because I'm so aware. And she is actually a good meditator, you know, because she's now so aware of her states of mind. So being mindful does not mean that you're always studied and that you're always focused and you're always calm. It doesn't mean anything. It just means that you're always aware of your states of mind as it's happening. And you take the responsibility to actually break the circuit. Okay? Now, the other important thing to understand is when you talk about mindfulness, you know that the Buddha talks about the four foundations of mindfulness, right? Anybody? Something's new? Anybody heard of four foundations of mindfulness? Okay. Anybody not heard of the four foundations of mindfulness? Okay. Basically, when the Buddha talks about right mindfulness, he's talking about developing awareness, right? Of A, the first foundation is the body, how you sit, how you eat, how you breathe, how you sleep, right? Everything that happens to your body sensation, and so on and so forth. The second foundations of mindfulness are the feelings. Now, from a meditation perspective, there's only three sets of feeling: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, right? When it's very hot, it's unpleasant. When it's 19 degrees, it's either pleasant or neutral. Okay? So how do we get things like, I dislike this, I'm anxious, I'm angry, I don't, you know, how do you get all the other things when it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? How do you get the other states of mind? And in the Buddhist text, the Buddha talks about 220 states of mind, more than any psychologist have found to date. Right? Because the states of mind and the emotions that the Buddha talked about are very subtle. Right? So how do you get all these variations of states of mind? That comes from the third foundation of mindfulness, which is about the contents of the mind. Right? And this is where you add value, the judgment. This is so unpleasant, it's so hot. Which idiot forgot to turn on the aircon? Right? Or somebody put something there and you accidentally kicked it and it hurts, right? But then you add all the mental contents, you know, they deserve, you know, nobody in this world, or, you know, the state government is so silly, they don't have enough people, they've set public servants, and all you did was you kicked a stone. Right? So when you add a lot of mental contents, that's where the agitation comes in. And that is the third foundation of mindfulness. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness are what the Buddha called the contents, the concepts of the mind, right, which actually hinders or helps your practice. Now, in terms of the Buddhist practice, they talk about the virtues like compassion, right, altruism, loving kindness, which actually helps to progress your meditation practice, or the hindrances like laziness, justification, excuse, and all that that says, oh, I cannot meditate today because whatever, right? But in terms of our own life, you can also see that we have these conditions that we apply to our life, right? I cannot be happy until I have the perfect job or the perfect car or the perfect house, or the perfect cushion. I cannot meditate because my cushion is floppy, right? And it's not the right color. I need a black cushion. And I need to have the Buddha statue in the right side, not the left side. And all that, and I cannot learn to meditate because I have to take 7 days from work and go for a retreat, right? The conditions that we place on our happiness or unhappiness. So basically what the Buddha is talking about in terms of the practice of mindfulness is that everything in our mind, our body, our feeling, our conditions, right, provides the basis for us to practice mindfulness and to be mindful about, right? So when you say, I have no time to meditate, what we are talking about is actually, I have no time to sit in practice, which is the formal meditation. Right? And that's fair now, although you can actually do that 5-10 minutes apart or whatever. But you know what? When you think about it, and if you're honest about it, we are very mindful of our body, feeling, states of mind, and the conditions of our mind, right? Except that we are mindful of it in a mindless way. Either after it happens, or when it's so full of junk, right? So it is not true that we are not mindful of the four foundations of mindfulness. We are just not mindful of it mindfully. Okay? Now, why is this so important to the attitude and to the practice of mindfulness? Because what the Buddha is talking about is if you understand that this whole process is actually separate, right? When you have some contact, your body feels it first, right? And then the mind starts to think about it, right? And then you start to conceptualize about it. You can actually break the circuit by seeing that, okay, I'm feeling my heart is pounding. I'm getting angry, dropped, right? And if that escapes it, you can go to the next stage and say, I'm feeling angry. You can still break the circuit. So if you see things as being a process, rather than one big chunk like that, you can actually break it in small parts. Does that make sense? And it's very important because it helps you to separate physical pain from emotional suffering. And what the Buddha is saying is that sometimes, in fact, all the time, being human, physical pain is unavoidable. As long as you live, you will die. As long as you live, you will hurt, you will suffer. Right? So that's inevitable. But emotional suffering is optional. because it's self-created in the mind by the third foundations of mindfulness, the conditions that you feel, the content that you fill up, right? And just to give you an example, while my husband is asleep so that he won't hear us, right? You see what I thought about Circuit Breaker? You mention his name, he wakes up. So, but this is a true story. As some of you who have been here before, you know that last year when we came, right, Charles was medically had a lot of problems, right? He had cancer operation, he had a back operation, he couldn't walk, he was in a wheelchair, and so on and so forth. And, you know, last 2 years was a very difficult year for us, to put it mildly. But the last operation he had last year was he had a major spinal operation. And when we saw the neurosurgeon, he was the first and only doctor I know that said to him, "I'm just curious that you are one of those few patients that actually don't use painkiller. You know how when you have operation, they put a drip and you're supposed to press and self-administer?" Well, Charles didn't use any of the drip. And then in the same thing with the cancer operation, the nurse got so upset when I told the surgeon. Surgeon said, "Give him some Panadol." Right? And he didn't want to take Panadol. He's a very difficult patient. So the cancer surgeon didn't say anything. But the neurosurgeon, the second one, actually brought it up and said, "I noticed in my chart that you actually don't use any of these painkillers. I wonder why." And Charles said to him, and I'm just summarizing, not quoting him, so he wouldn't get it. You know, say I misquote him or something. He said, "I accept that I had a major operation. There's bound to be pain, right? So that's this acceptance. You know, it's painful, the operation." He says, "Every time I have pain, I breathe through the pain because I know that the pain is a process. It will come and it will go, right?" So Charles is actually practicing all the attitude that the Buddha talks about, the acceptance, the letting go, ability to let be. And the neurosurgeon was so amazed. He said, "You know, so many..." And this is the nice part about it. He's so humble. He said, "I've been a surgeon for so long, and I'm still fascinated about the power of the mind and body." Right? And he says, "Where does this come from?" So we told him about meditation. We told him about John Kabat-Zinn's work. And he said, "I want to read more about it." So I sent him all the CDs and all that. Now, I tell this story to show you that actually the attitude that the Buddha is teaching is not something in the textbook or something that you just put away. It's something that actually if you embody and practice it, it helps you, right? And I mean, for Charles' incident, it's a really good illustration of the differentiation between physical pain, which is a lot, and emotional suffering. Because emotional suffering is pain multiplied by resistance. And that pain could be anything. Not wanting to let go of your life, or not accepting what's happening. Plus the resistance, you get emotional suffering. Because that comes in the mind. The second point about this story is that this is a doctor who is so mindful. He's one of the few doctors, as I said, who actually looks at the chart. And he has a beginner's mind and said, "How come you didn't use any painkiller?" Now, how many doctors actually, they might look at it, but how many doctors actually take it upon themselves to want to know about it, right? And how many of them are humble enough to say, "I'm curious," right? And be honest enough to say, "I didn't know about the power of the mind and body. I want to know more," right? Now, to me, that is a mindful doctor as opposed to a doctor who practices mindfulness. Right? So again, what the Buddha is talking about is being mindful, not just practicing mindfulness. And I get a lot of concerns because I get a lot of psychologists and colleagues and people like that who say, "Oh, you know, now there's so many millions of people wanting to do mindfulness," right? I get colleagues that say, "Can you teach me mindfulness?" I'm not sure how to teach mindfulness to begin with. But I first asked them, I said, "Do you have a meditation practice?" "No. Never heard of meditation, never sat before." "Why do you want to do a meditation? Why do you want to do a mindfulness?" "Oh, it's a buzzword. All my clients are asking for it. So I want to incorporate into my repertoire." And that's what's happening. And there is a difference between somebody using mindfulness as a skill, as a technique, and somebody who is mindful. And as I said to this neurosurgeon, he may not have heard of mindfulness and meditation and all that, but he is a very mindful doctor. Do you see the difference? Right? So the attitude the Buddha talked about is being mindful, not acquiring mindfulness technique. Okay? Now where am I? Now I have to learn mindfulness. Okay. Now, the other thing about this attitude is, and also being mindful, is it actually helps us to distinguish between the kind of self-knowledge that we talk about. Now, what are the two types of knowledge? What I call knowing about yourself and knowing yourself. Right? For example, the same thing. For me, knowing about me and knowing me. Knowing about me, you know that, you know, I'm a lecturer, I'm a psychologist, I'm a lawyer, and all that kind of thing. That's a knowledge about oneself, right? And that I can share with you very easily. And the jokes I tell about my husband is all knowledge about myself. But knowing myself is knowing how I would respond moment to moment to situation that I encounter. It's about my ability to respond. Does that make sense? Right? Yeah, so what the Buddha is teaching is actually giving us the skill to know ourselves and then be able to respond. Okay? Like, for example, when I get stressed about something, I know that my reaction is probably going to be annoyance. That's knowing myself. Right? But knowing that I'm a lawyer, knowing that I'm a psychologist, does not help me to know how I would respond moment to moment. Right? But most of us actually know ourselves. Sorry, know about ourselves, but we don't know ourselves. And meditation gives you that capacity because it gives you the space of mind to actually see how you are reacting or responding moment by moment. And one of the things I was telling the doctors last time was interesting. They all came in and everything, and I said to them, I'm sorry, I have to tell you, you guys have a fatal disease that I know the symptoms, but there's no solution and there's no cure, and it's fatal. And the doctor said, please, please, whatever it is, we want to know. And I said, it's called being human. Right? And it's true. Because a lot of them come with stress that you think it would really bother a human being. And doctors, I mean, I have a lot of respect for doctors because they are on call all the time. The demand is very high. But I say at some point of time, you need to know you can't manage this. And to be aware of your human limitations, right? Like all of us, any one of us, whether you're a mother, a daughter, a student, an employee or whatever, there is a time when you, beyond that, you know that you are inefficient. Right? But doctors, because they see that as a vocation, they tend not to do that. So when I told them that they suffer from this fatal disease called human being, they were quite shocked. Right? Because very often we don't realize that being human is actually such a joy, such an experience. Right? Because can you imagine if we don't die? If we don't die, what happens? We think we have this forever, right? We don't even start to enjoy the present moment, isn't it? Because it's going to last. I get worried when I hear the doctors say that they're going to make sure that people live to 120. I don't want to live to 120, right? Because then I will be like, if I'm 120, I can live to 120, I'll be like my grandson's age. Can you imagine having to go through the whole life again? And Charles will be middle age. Right? But it doesn't matter. The point is, a lot of us are now focused on quantity, right? But how many of us are focused on quality? So now we want to know our emails as soon as they arrive with our pebble watched. We're not worried about whether that email is going to send us, make us stressful. I mean, why? Why do you need to know it 2 minutes before you're due to see it? As if you're going to be able to answer. I mean, they'll probably give you a watch and reply, "I'm not home." What? You know what I mean? What is the information going to do for you? Right? And that really worries me. Okay, I'm going to finish up here and then open the floor for discussion. So basically, and I'd like to finish with Rahula saying, that Buddhism is a way of life, and to become a Buddhist, there are no external rites or ceremonies to follow, but merely to understand and practice the Buddha's teaching. And there is a Chinese proverb which I think captures the teachings very well. It says that I see and I remember, right? You see things, you remember. But when I do, I understand. Thank you. Okay. Any questions, besides from Charles? John.
Can you give us an overview of the course in Massachusetts Health Center that you studied, the mindfulness course?
Uh-huh.
Tell us something about the modules.
Are you planning to study?
No, I'm definitely not going, but I'd like to know, it's so far away, let's get an overview of that course.
Well, it's very hard to give you an overview, but I can give you the reference. You can go to the Center for Mindfulness to find that they have a detailed course. But basically, what the course involves is 8 weeks of training where you actually sit in meditation the whole day. You wake up in the morning, you sit, and you sit and you watch your mind, and at the end of the day, there is a Dharma talk. I mean, they don't call it Dharma talk, there's a discussion. And then so if you're going for the 8 days program with Charles Das, right, then every week you have a homework, which the homework is basically for you to journal what your feelings are. I went for the intensive where I did 10 days in a row, okay, because I couldn't take 8 weeks away. And basically, by the third day onwards, it's noble silence. So you don't talk to people. You just sit there and watch your mind. Right? And also the other thing that they want to do to reduce the self is you're not supposed to tell people who you are. First of all, because it's distracting to you and to other people, right? And also they don't want you to chatter along, "Oh, I'm a psychologist," and then people start to tell you their problems and so on and so on. So everybody is equal, right? And also they mix the teachers and the patient. So there are people with lots of pain and everything. So nobody knows who is the teacher and who is the people like us who go there to learn. So everybody is equal. But most of the day, you sit, you watch, you eat, all mindfully. And the third day onwards, no email, everybody goes crazy. Right? Fourth day, no talking, they go worst. And so on and so forth. And some of them quit after the fourth or fifth day. But that's all it is.
So there's no intensive reading and writing?
They give you two books, which is John's book and Saki's book, which is Heal Yourself, and it's optional, right? And they give you a journal. So for the patient, that's what they do. For us who are training to be instructors, we get a little bit more of a manual. But you know what? I've forgotten the manual because I don't actually teach Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Center, which is MBSR. I just inculcate the principles. Besides, I mean, there are lots of us who's already very imbued with the Dharma. You know, when I go there, Charles and I, we just go there to find out what the course is about. We don't actually teach MBSR. What we do is, I just to check. You know, when I train people in mindfulness, I train a lot of people managing stress through mindfulness, organizations, airlines, and things like that. Basically, I ask them to watch their mind.
So there's no daily lecture
then? There is a talk. No,
talk.
Yeah, no lecture. But the the requirements to get in is quite tough, and one of the requirements is you must have done a 7-day silent retreat before, because so much of the course training is in silence retreat that some people, if they haven't had this training before, they would not be able to sit there for 7 days in silence, right? So they want to make sure that you're not going to freak out if you don't talk to anybody for 7 days, okay? So they require that you have to have this training, and they want to see your motivation, why you going there for this training, and so on and so forth. But you can get more details on their website, John. Okay? Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. May I have a little bit more regarding, water?
Yeah.
Regarding on being mindfulness, being mindful, you were mentioning that we should learn how to be mindful instead of learning mindfulness as a skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying is that not many people were born with the ability to be mindful.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people, how do you actually, you know, learn that or be a mindful person if you're not born with that?
Okay, that's a very good question. Just for the audience, the question was, you know, some of us are not born mindful, and so when I talk about mindfulness not being a skill or technique, how do we actually acquire this skill or technique to be mindful? Is that right? Is that your question?
Yeah, but you're saying it's not good to see it as a skill, but say if you don't have that when you were born, then how would you sort of adapt that?
Okay, let me first correct this misimpression. All of us are mindful. All of us are born mindful. Like John often say, and you can read a lot of the Dharma teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh and all that, mindfulness is a universal capacity. My husband often said that if you're not mindful, you'll be dead because you cannot survive, right? If you're not mindful, you walk into a car. You'll be eaten. You'll be stung by the spider or whatever, right? We are mindful. That's why we're still alive. Isn't that right? Right? Now, so the point is what we are mindful about. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. Most of the time, we are very mindful of a lot of rubbish, right? So we are not mindful, M-I-N-D-F-U-L. We are mindful, M-I-N-D-F-U-L-L. Our mind is so full, right? So mindfulness is actually what they call awareness, right? It's big awareness, matter awareness. You're aware when you walk. You do not move these things, right? Isn't it? You're aware. Right? And all these things that make you alive, you are aware. So it is wrong to think of mindfulness as some skill or ability that I have to go and acquire. Like, sorry?
When you finish, can I say something?
I mean, you put it so nicely, like, do I have a choice? Okay, wait, let me finish this first, okay? So, when you have to distinguish between formal meditation, where you're actually training and disciplining your mind to come back and focus on the present, which actually provides the training for you to actually stay in the present. Because mindfulness is about being present, being aware of what's happening to you as it is happening. That's all it is, right? But for you to actually train your mind to come back whenever it goes all over, it's where the skill of the discipline, the meditation, allowing the breath to come back. So that's the only skill you need to acquire, is to bring your mind back to whatever it's doing. Does that make sense? So there's no special skill as a skill of mindfulness. It's actually training your mind to come back to the present. Does that make sense?
So meditation is regarded as a tool pack.
That's right. It's like a foundation.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you go to the gym once a month and you said, how come I got no muscle? Right? You have to go every day to acquire the muscle. So the mind is like that. You have to train every day through the sitting meditation to give your mind and muscle so that when you're present, you're present. Okay? Charles, it's being recorded, so you have to speak up a bit louder.
Just a matter of time here. Everybody in this today, since 30 years ago when John Kabat-Zinn wrote the book Full Catastrophe Living, people have taken into the MBS, our program, which is mindfulness-based stress reduction program, and focus on mindfulness. So now you have mindful everything, mindful childbearing, mindful this, mindful that, you know, and there are millions of exponential writings on mindfulness. The Buddha's teaching is not about mindfulness, right mindfulness. And the Buddha is the first naturalist, like what he's teaching is survival. If you were not mindful, you would walk into a car, wouldn't you? You weren't mindful, you wouldn't know you were sick, would you? If you weren't mindful right now, you would sit here and listen to me, wouldn't you, rather than go home and rest? You know, little things like that is a reflection of your mind being there all the time. The thing about lack of mindfulness, the right mindfulness, lack of mindfulness, is not because we're not mindful. It's because our minds cannot stand still. We're always mindful of, like Belinda says, full of all sorts of things. So instead of listening, we make comments as we listen. Right now you're thinking, who is this bugger talking? You know, what's he got to, you know? So your mind, you make judgments and your mind goes ruminating. And this is where meditation comes in. In meditation, what you do is you free yourself from your thoughts. Can you imagine if you didn't have any thoughts and you didn't have any sensations, you didn't have any feelings, how peaceful it would be? And if you've meditated long enough, you know that peace. That peace only comes about because you free your mind from your habitual ruminations. You see? So it's only a skill. Meditation doesn't make you mindful, doesn't make you anything special. It's a skill to still your mind so that you can not have all these ruminations and free your mind. And when you have a clear, free your mind like that, you have a clear mind. So when you listen to people, you listen to them quietly instead of all the noises in your mind. You listen to them quietly, you hear what they say. Right now, you hear half of what I say. You know? So a meditator is able to sort of say, okay, I'm here to hear you and hear everything. And then they make the comments afterwards. That's mindfulness. You are aware when you are in meditation of your body. You are aware of your thoughts. You are aware of your emotions. Some people cannot meditate because their emotions come and you know, psychotic situations. So they find it very difficult to meditate. But the point is, you are aware. Mindfulness is about being aware moment to moment. And we are aware because there's so many times we say or do something, and just as you said it, I should have bit my tongue, I should have said that. I've annoyed this person, it's wrong, I shouldn't have done this. How often does it happen to you? Of course, with you guys, you probably doesn't matter you because you practice mindfulness, but this is how we operate. We get there just before. We always react just before, and then we hurt somebody's feelings or we say the wrong thing. We cannot take it back. Mindfulness, you don't react. You just clear your mind and you listen. After you listen, then you can hit back. So that's the difference. But if you can do that, you have got no problem with communications. Because half the time, you didn't mean to say that. You didn't mean to do this. You know, you sort of, just that moment of reactivity, you react rather than respond. So you train your mind not to react. Just to be calm, listen quietly, and then respond. And you save yourself a lot of bother because a lot of disputes arises from misunderstanding. That's another term there. Right understanding.
Charles, yeah. Thank
okay?
Does that help your question? Yeah. That's another question. Anybody else?
Sorry.
All right. Well, Belinda, would you consider the Buddha what? A great philosopher?
There's a lot of confusion.
Sorry. Yeah.
Would you consider the Buddha a great philosopher?
I mean, I think that there's a question that takes too long to answer. I mean, to me, he's the greatest psychologist. But more than that, he's just human.
But isn't he a philosopher?
I mean, like people ask the Buddha, you know, who makes God and things like that. The question, the answer I would give you, John, is what the Buddha says. How does that question help you to live your life better? If that answer, whether the Buddha is a philosopher or not, helps you to live your life better, that's fine. If the answer does not help you to live your life better, then maybe you should ask yourself, why do I need to know whether the Buddha is a philosopher or not? Because like that story I told you earlier on, this young man that wanted to follow the Buddha, listened to this person and his sermons make sense and he followed without knowing whether he's the Buddha or not. Right? So I think the question of whether the Buddha is a philosopher, a psychologist, or anything does not matter as long as you understand what he's really trying to teach. And to understand that, you have to practice that, like what Charles is saying. You have to be there, not think about it. Right? So your question about what is the skill to acquire, there's no skill to acquire, it's just that the meditation trains you to be present. That's all. Okay.
We have that skill.
Yeah, we have it. Because if we don't have it, as I said, we will not be alive. We will be walking into a car. Okay? Now, any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, would you your hand up first? No, okay. Fine.
So
can you speak a bit louder so that they can record your question?
Okay. So back to about meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So I often heard about meditating and thinking about an answer to a question. I heard about meditating and thinking about contemplating about a question.
I don't understand.
I mean, I've heard like say.
Give me an example.
So like, I watched a Zen documentary. And
yes.
Like, so the Zen master gave the monk. Question, and then he's supposed to think on that.
Okay.
And is this like so? In meditation, do you really are you really supposed to think about
right.
this question, or are you supposed to only
right? So the question is, let me see whether I got your question right.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is about meditation. Do you just meditate, or do you think about a question that the meditation teacher may give you? I think there's a confusion there about different traditions of meditation. Okay? In the Theravadan tradition, it's the easiest and the simplest, and this is the way the Buddha taught it many, many years ago, is you just sit and you focus on your breath. Every time the mind wanders, you bring it back to an object of focus, which happens to be the breath, it could be a flower, it could be anything. Now, the Zen tradition, when Buddhism went to Japan, and they also incorporate a lot of Shintoism, has a different technique of actually encouraging people to meditate. And they have this practice called koan, K-A-O-N. Now, koan is a question that the teacher gives to the student, which doesn't have an intellectual answer. So that you're forced not to use your intellect to answer that. Right? For example, What is the sound of one hand clapping? Right? Now the idea is to understand the cause and effect. Right? Because one hand you cannot clap. So if somebody makes you angry and you don't respond, there is no reaction. Okay? That kind of question. That they will have another Quran that says, for example, right? The trees are falling but there's nobody to hear it. What does that mean? Right? So they ask you to think. But Zen practice is hard for beginners. Right? Because first of all, you've got to actually be able to see that you're applying your intellect to think about the question. Right? And also, then your mind will be very focused on what is the correct answer and so on and so forth. Right? So I think that for beginners, it's actually better to use the simplest form, which is the Theravadan tradition. Now, I learned all the forms, I learned Tibetan and all that, but when I teach, I usually use the Theravadan approach, which is just to focus on the mind, right? Because the questions get in the way. When you're very trained and very disciplined, and the Quran is a way of actually cutting through that intellect, answer your question? Right? And yeah, this Ajahn Brahm is very cute. Ajahn Brahm, you know, he is the abbot in Serpentine in Western Australia, right? Yeah. Somebody asked him, can you please give me an advice on how to meditate? Like, what's the best way? Use Quran, use this and all that. Ajahn Brahm said, because I was on the same panel with him, he said, very simple, right? When you meditate, breathing in, shut. Breathing out, up. Shut up, shut up, shut up. And he says, that's basically what meditation is about, is to shut up the mind. Right? And I think that's great. It cuts through that, right? So you breathe, shut. Because basically, your mind is, like Charles said, is all over the place, is ruminating, is judging, is evaluating, and so on and so forth. So for somebody who is not trained, if you use the Zen technique, you'll get more and more into intellectualization. And that's why the Zen teachers, when they teach you, they take a stick, right? Because they want to cut through the intellectualism, right? Now, people do not understand why the approach and philosophy behind it. Then they want to know what kind of stick is the right stick. Right? The whole idea is to cut off the stick. Right? And I remember another story where this person wanted to find the best meditation teacher. So he said to these different teachers, he went and tested them with this question. He's an academic, intellectual person. Right? Said, so what is the right way to eat in meditation? And the teacher refused to answer and said, what is the right food to eat? The teacher refused to answer and he went on and on and on and on and on. So finally he asked the teacher, what is the right food to eat? And finally the Zen teacher said to him, what is in front of you? Right? So you eat what's in front of you instead of asking what is the right food to eat, when to eat, how to eat, which is all about the intellect. You be present and you just do it. So meditation is about embodying it, putting in practice, right? And you can meditate when you're in shower, right? You don't have to sit in formal meditation, right? Like when I teach professional people and I ask them, how many people took a shower with you? And they get very upset because they think I'm asking about their sex life. And I say, I'm serious. And I said, because usually when we're showering, right, we're already starting to think about the meeting. And I'm sure that the next thing they will ask, they will start to, you know, Samsung and all that, they will properly organize a waterproof email. So that you can actually start emailing while you are. Right? Because that's what we do. We are not actually with the water. We're not with anything that we're doing. We already mind is thinking, right? And one of the participants was very honest. He says, actually, last night I bathed with 22 people. Because he's already thinking about the meeting, he's going tomorrow, and so on and so forth. You know? So he neither is at the meeting, right? Nor is he with the shower. Both of them are shortchanged. So meditation is to be where you are at the same time you're doing it.
Meditation is to be present, not somewhere else. Your mind is either forward or backwards, but never here.
You know, John Cabazan has a funny illustration. He said, we often live in two addresses, right? The past or the future. We're never living at the current address that we're living, which is the present. You think about it, right? Either in the past or in the future.
There's no truth in the past or the future. The only truth is now.
Right? Because what is happening now is really what's happening to you. What is in the past cannot come back and hurt you unless you put it in your mind. What is happening in the future cannot affect you yet.
It need not happen.
Right? And when you think about it, you worry about Monday. This is Sunday, you worry about Monday. You actually cannot do anything about Monday till you're actually in Monday, right? But when you're in Sunday worrying about Monday, what you've done is you wasted Sunday. And when it comes to Monday, you're going to waste Monday again. Because you can only deal with Monday when Monday comes. So that's why the Buddha talks about the present moment. Right? Because that is the only moment you have Monday. It's Monday. Sunday cannot be Monday. Right? Okay, any other questions?
So another question about you said about the beginner's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So does it come automatically from being mindful?
What do you think? Okay, answer that question yourself.
Well,
the question is, does a beginner's mind automatically come from being mindful?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, sometimes...
Okay, that is my Quran for you. For the next 5 minutes, you for the next 5 minutes, while I answer other questions, you think and say, okay, you're here with me. Do you have a beginner's mind, or are you judging and evaluating? So does mindfulness equate a beginner's mind? You'll find out for yourself, okay? Right. Any other question?
I think you should revisit your question, what is a beginner's mind? What do you understand by beginner's mind?
Yeah, but Charles, if you don't mind, I let him, yeah, right. I because you are now mindful, right? You are listening to me, you're not being interrupted. Ask yourself whether there's anything in your mind. Are you practicing a beginner's mind, or is there something else? Okay? Just for 1 minute, yeah, while I answer this question.
Can you expand on
how
you're talking about the 19 temple and the three Buddhas,
yeah,
and the three different expressions? Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't visited Wollongong Temple for some time, but I know that in the main meditation hall there is three very big Buddhist statues, right? The statue of the Buddha, and that's true of most Buddhist temples, right? But what I'm saying is that a lot of people tend to worship the statues, right? They put candles and they light things and everything. But what the whole statues are about is for us to actually try and incorporate the virtues of that particular Buddha into our own lives. So if you, for example, you want to visualize the Buddha of compassion, it's so that you can actually inculcate compassion in your heart. It's not to pray to the Buddha of compassion.
Oh, okay, so I thought you meant the three Buddhas were like, the positive feeling, neutral and...
No, it's not. It's just different. And this is more the Mahayana, the Tibetan styles, where they have different images of the Buddha. In the Theravadan style or in the Zen style, there's usually no image. But the image, as I said, serves as a point of visualization for you to actually practice that virtue. It is not a point of worship. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Okay, now, have you found your beginner's mind?
Well, I think it depends on how you define mindfulness.
Uh-huh.
So, if beginner mind is to approach a problem without any preconception,
uh-huh,
then being mindfulness is just realizing what you are doing, and that can also bring into the equation other things, other memories which is associated with the thing you are thinking.
Right. So can I just repeat? So what he's saying, what's your name?
Brandon.
Brandon is saying that being mindful, you're also mindful that there's preconception and other evaluation,
yeah,
right, as you're doing things. So what is the difference with a beginner's mind?
I'm not sure whether beginner's mind is supposed to mean to be without those preconceptions.
That's right. So when you have a beginner's mind, what it means is that your mind is open, right? You don't come in with prejudgment and filters and things like that, right? But mindfulness helps you to cultivate a beginner's mind in the sense that when you have a lot of judgment and preconception, you are aware that a lot of things are going on. Like Charles said, you then calm yourself down, you clear your mind so that you can cultivate a beginner's mind. But a beginner's mind does not come from mindfulness or anything. Beginner's mind is just a way of looking like a child. Oh, everything is so cute. Everything is so fun. It got nothing to do with mindfulness, right? But being mindful, you're aware there's so much junk in your mind, you have to clear it before you can actually have a beginner's mind, right? I mean, talk about romantic love. Romantic love is very good, right? Beginner's mind, because everything you see about the other person is good, right? Even when they sleep and snore and everything, they still, everything is so beautiful. Right? You have in, when you're first infatuated, right? When you're infatuated, you have beginner's mind because everything is beautiful. Oh, curious. Okay, you know, my boyfriend talks to me for hours and hours. Oh, it's so exciting. Everything is beginner's mind. And then 3 months later, oh, it's so boring. I can't even get to sleep. Right? You start to judge. You start to filter. You're still present, except you're not present to the snoring and grumbling and this and that. But you don't have that curiosity. You don't have that kind of child's mind, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So in order to get back to that kind of romantic beginner's mind, you probably have to clear your mind and say, okay, you know, he snores and all that kind of thing, but he's still a nice person. Right? Yeah. So mindfulness helps you to be aware that you don't have a beginner's mind and to get back to that. Okay? All right. Good question. Thank you.
It's about acceptance. We are so conditioned that we don't accept anything. A beginner's mind, there's clear of any condition. Everything is fresh. And then you evaluate on the basis of what is clear, not conditioned. We don't have taste, we don't have preferences, we don't have everything. Like a child, before a child learns to be corrupted. That's true, the parents corrupt them.
You know, there is a very good research in America about this beginner's mind, and what they did was they rang a bell, and they have a group of people who are not experienced meditators and very experienced Zen meditators, right? And they ring the bell, ding, 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 like 20 times or something. The people who are not experienced meditators, after a while, they habituate to it. That means they stop listening to the bell, right? They just go to the background, right? The monks, every time the bell rings, they hear it with the beginner's mind, fresh. Ding. The second bell, ting. The 20th bell, they hear it's fresh again, ting. Whereas the beginner meditators, by the 20th bell, they're asleep. Right? That is the beginner's mind. Everything is new, everything is fresh, everything is always joyful, or everything is sad. So you don't get the past to say, okay, this is like that yesterday, it's going to be like this again. So everything is beginner's mind. So it's a better of attitude. Right? Okay, yeah. Anything else?
Can I put a final question? In your
About philosophy?
In your own conception, is mindfulness part of consciousness, or it is essentially consciousness itself?
John, I'm sorry. I would like to answer this question, but I really don't think we have time to do this.
Brilliant.
And also, as I said, if it helps you to live a better life, I'm happy to answer that. But I think it would confuse more people than actually help them. Because whether it's part of consciousness or not, mindfulness is about being
it
alive.
It is a part of awareness.
Then it's part of consciousness.
I know, but I don't want to get into this argument or a debate, or because A, it's late, and B, I don't think it's really helpful. Okay? There's lots of books on that if you want to read. I'm happy to give you the time. Now, it's past the time. I'm happy to stay here and talk, but anybody who wants to leave, you can actually leave without being rude. So I won't take any offense if you want to go early, but if you have questions and you want to answer, well, I'm happy to answer. But I just don't feel that philosophical question, John, is appropriate when you have to go into a lot of theory.
I don't think you need to. You can condense it in a very...
Yes, I know, but I don't have the time, nor do I have the expertise.
These senior undergraduates, they do have the caliber to...
Yes, I understand, but I don't
have
the
expertise.
I don't have the expertise to engage in this, and I really don't want. I don't want really
you
want
to engage in idle speculation.
That, yeah, but I don't want to engage in this.
Yes.
Any other questions?
We've just reached the end, I suppose.
It's okay. As I said, you know, if you want to go. If you want to stay. So I know sometimes you've got questions that you want to ask personally. I'm happy to stay